The Carleton College Convocation Program is a weekly lecture series that brings fresh insights and perspectives from experts in a variety of fields. The program has a rich history dating back several decades. The selected convocation speakers assist the liberal arts mission of centering thoughtful conversations within education and beyond.
Hello and good morning. My name is, like he already said, Tegan Klinkner. I am a senior political science and Russian double major here at Carleton, and I have the pleasure of introducing today's convocation speaker, Dr. Fiona Hill. Dr. Hill started her career off with a master's in Soviet studies and a doctorate in history from Harvard University. She later received a master's in Russian and modern history from St. Andrews University in Scotland and has since continued her education through the Moscow Marie Thoras Institute of Foreign Languages. During her doctoral studies, she worked for the Eurasia Foundation as a director of strategic planning and led projects focusing on democracy, ethnic conflicts, and Russia's foreign relations in a post-Soviet world. In 2003, she published her first book, The Siberian Curse: How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold. This, along with several other pieces, discuss the multifaceted issues plaguing Russia, as well as the conflicts and security issues in the Caucasus, Central Asia, and more. Dr. Hill has played an instrumental role in U.S. intelligence, serving as the National Intelligence Officer for the Russia and Eurasia at the National Security Intelligence Council from 2006 to 2009. She also served as the Deputy Assistant to the President and the Senior Director for the European and Russian Affairs on the U.S. National Security Council from 2017 to 2019. Since 2000, she has been a fellow at the Brookings Institute and is currently one of their senior fellows in the Foreign Policy Program's Center for the United States and Europe. Beyond her incredible career in national security, foreign policy, and writing, she has brought her expertise back into the educational realm. Dr. Hill is a fellow at the Robert Bash Academy in Berlin, was appointed chancellor of Durham University in the UK, and is a member of the Alumni Association Council at Harvard University Graduate School. On behalf of Carleton College, I thank you for this opportunity to learn about navigating a world in turmoil. And with that, please welcome Dr. Fiona Hill.
Thank you very much to Tegan and also to Noel. The safety announcements is very important. I was noticing that there's a very handy fire extinguisher just here. Hopefully I will not set the place on fire, but you know, you never know. I've also got a bottle of water, so maybe that will be helpful. I see there's still quite a few people coming in the back, and please feel free to come in. I won't be distracted, don't worry, and because I've got it written out for a change instead of just talking extemporaneously. And there are also some seats over here and over here. I'm really thrilled to be at Carleton College. It's actually my first visit, but I do have a connection. In fact, my connections are sitting over here. My cousin Marie and her partner Caleb are graduates of this fine institution. And I understand there's a lot of people who are newly admitted and perhaps some of their parents here today. I think you can't go wrong. Marie and Caleb had a wonderful experience here, and it's partly in tribute to them, to the finest people I know, that I'm here. So I'm really thrilled to be here, and thank you for giving me this chance to take part in the convocations. I also want to say that these convocations are pretty remarkable. So for those of you who are not aware of them, I don't know really of any other place that does something like this every week. And, you know, I certainly wish I'd come to an institution that had, you know, basically a speech about something different every single week. Most places didn't have the funding, or maybe they're just the stamina, you know, for something like this. So, you know, you tend to have monthly convocations or speaking or, you know, a couple of times a year. So this is remarkable. And I do, you know, really hope that Carleton keeps this up. And I know that they're on all kinds of different themes. I just heard from Noel one coming up on food security. I don't know whether it also comes with a cooking demonstration, but you know, you never know. But I'm going to talk today about, you know, geopolitics and global issues. That's obviously what I'm trained in. As Tegan mentioned, you know, I've done a lot of work on Russia and what was then the former Soviet Union and Europe and, you know, kind of broader regions. But I want to talk about this in a much more global context because, you know, quite frankly, as the title of the talk says, we're really, all of us, trying to navigate at the moment a world in turmoil. So I want to kind of lay out a few things for us to think about. I'm also going to look to Noel and Tegan for telling me when I've been talking for too long so we can get some questions and answers as well, because I'm sure you've all got a lot of things on your mind. And certainly from my perspective, you know, working at the Brookings Institution, where we have a very global program in foreign policy studies, for all of us there, it's certainly the case that October 7th of last year was really a pretty monumental date, because the world suddenly became a whole lot more complex and very difficult to navigate for all of us watching things from the Brookings Institution or here, obviously in universities and university campuses, but also for the United States and the Western Alliance. I would actually say that Hamas's surprise attack on Israel was a Pearl Harbor moment, and I want to explain that for a moment, because that might not really make a lot of sense for everybody, although it might, you know, for some of you who are historians or thinking about world affairs out there. Because what it did was open up another major power regional conflict and another front for, you know, all of us in thinking about what's happening, in addition to the war in Ukraine. And I want to talk about this for a while. Certainly what happened on October 7th has upset our domestic politics, and not just here, but in many other places as well. It's pulled the United States into the Middle East in ways that it was trying to extricate itself. And it's also brought a lot of other players into the region. And, you know, set, I think, you know, a tone that's going to affect our elections here in the United States, but also elections elsewhere. And I'm going to talk about that as we go ahead. Now, Pearl Harbor, the actual Pearl Harbor back in 1941, marked the entry of the United States into World War II. And it also started World War II with Germany's invasion of Poland, so events in Europe. And ended, of course, after the US attack, nuclear attack on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I'm not saying that we're in World War III, just in case you're all panicking and running for the exits and the fire extinguisher. But what I am saying is that the international system is in a lot of peril at the moment. And that international system, of course, was set up after World War II to try to prevent the outbreak of major conflicts again. And just like in the 1940s, we've now got an international system, a global order in flux. We've got the balance of power shifting in all kinds of different regions. And the mechanisms that we put in place to basically secure the peace after World War II, and also to maintain peace after the end of the Cold War in 1989, have all been really challenged. And we're seeing major countries globally now assessing their positions and relationships with the United States, the West, and each other. So again, the world is in considerable periods of turmoil. Also, we have three sets of conflicts, not just the two, Middle East and in Europe, right now that have become intertwined, and I want to talk about that for a moment as well. And the US is unfortunately a protagonist in all three of these. And then there's a lot of demand for US diplomatic attention to lots of other conflicts, because there's not just three areas of conflict in the world, and I'll mention that as well. So first of all, we've got this European land war in Ukraine, which is not that dissimilar from that, you know, first period of land war in Europe back in World War II with the invasion of Poland. We've got now a full-on war in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas in the wake of October 7th. And as a result of all the missile attacks that we just saw in the last few days from Iran, we've got real risks right now of this becoming a regional war. We're all wondering, what is Israel going to do? What are others going to do? You know, what's going to happen more broadly in the Middle East? And I didn't get a chance to read up on everything that was happening in the last couple of hours, but I mean, it's really in that mode now that we're waiting every moment to see what happens next. And then on the third front, we have all of these rising tensions in East Asia, in the what we're now calling the Indo-Pacific, obviously all circling around what's going to happen with China and Taiwan, and will the US inevitably be pulled into yet another war, but this time in East Asia. Now, Russia is a key player in all three of these conflicts. Most people tend to forget, but not Tegan, because she's studying Russia, as is many other people here, that Russia is also a power in Northeast Asia, and Russia has all kinds of disputes with other countries, as well as relationships there. And I want to look, because I've just mentioned Russia, which is also a player in, obviously, Europe and the Middle East, a little bit, as I begin, about the current state of the conflict in Ukraine and Russia, because we're obviously all wondering what's going to happen next on this as well. Lots of debates in Congress about Ukraine and big questions about how things are going to be decided. And if we think about these last 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we've had lots of ups and downs. And unfortunately, right now, the tide seems to have shifted against Ukraine. It has obviously beaten back a full-on Russian military invasion. Ukraine is not overrun. It's not part of Russia at this particular point, as it could have been in a formal sense, or at least part of a union arrangement that Russia has with Belarus. And we never talk about Belarus these days because it's sort of vanished, even though it's actually still there in plain sight. But that's what we were all anticipating was going to happen to Ukraine, you know, 2 years ago in February 2022. So Ukraine has not been defeated, you know, completely, but you would think it had been, given all of the pessimistic commentary that we now have in the press. Senator J.D. Vance, you know, most recently writing an opinion piece about that. But Ukraine is also not prevailing in the way that it was, say, a year ago on the battlefield. And Ukraine's best bet right now is to have a really defensive strategy to hunker down and, you know, deny Russia a victory. Now, you know, as I said, unfortunately, Ukraine, things have been going differently. And that's partly because Putin certainly seems to be riding high and seems to be winning. In fact, he wants us all to think he's winning. And he did, in fact, win recently his election in March of 2024. And now he's focused on delegitimizing President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who's had to postpone the Ukrainian presidential election because obviously it's pretty difficult having an election in the middle of a wartime. And Putin is, as I said, right now trying to convince all of us that he's won not just at the ballot box, but also on the battlefield. Now, first of all, the winning in the ballot box, I'll just be frank, the Russia's March election was a farce. Let's just be honest about it. Putin's own only real political competitor was Alexei Navalny, who obviously was not given a chance to run, and not only was he not given a chance, he was actually imprisoned in a penal colony in Siberia and died exactly a month before the election, which probably was not a coincidence. And then anybody else who was allowed to run in the election was so marginal that people had never heard of them, or if they looked suddenly like they might be getting some traction, was marginalized and actually not allowed to campaign. So in effect, Putin was re-anointed as a kind of modern czar as a result of this election. He got a ridiculous 88% of the vote. And I say ridiculous because he's never even had a higher vote in previous elections, and he's had quite a few of them at this particular point. So let's just say he's over-fulfilled the electoral plan there, but has ensconced himself back in the presidency. And I think if we look at this point, apart from defeating Ukraine and overturning, you know, a lot of global order in the process, Putin's plan is to stay in power as long as possible. He can stay in office right now until 2030, and he can also run for re-anointment again for another 6 years out to 2036. He's already been in power for 25 years, by the way. We're in his 25th year. And I think this is important for Putin, so I'm just going to mention it. If he does get to 2030, he will have outlasted Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, who was in office for 30 years from 1922 to 1952. And if he makes it out till 2036, and I think this is actually one of the reasons he's thinking that long, he will have outlasted the Empress Catherine the Great, who Putin likes to model himself off. I mean, he doesn't run around in, you know, fancy dress, dressed as Catherine the Great, but he certainly thinks about her quite a lot, has a big statue of her in one of his offices. She was, of course, a German who became Russian Empress, but she ruled for a whopping 34 years from 1762 to 1296. 1296, that doesn't work, does it? 1796. Putin is always taking us back, however, into prehistory, and he's always talking about Catherine the Great's conquests of Ukraine and a very other territory. So Catherine the Great is always on his mind. And Putin clearly sees himself right now as a historic figure, at home as well as abroad. That brings me back to where I started, October 7th. Some of you probably know this already. Fun fact, it was Putin's birthday on October 7th. He was born October 7th, 1952. And all kinds of things tend to happen on Putin's birthday, and there's some speculation out there, but I wouldn't take, you know, too much notice of it out on the internet, suspecting that saying that Hamas did it because it was Putin's birthday. I doubt that. But nonetheless, nasty things do happen on Putin's birthday. And in 2006, one of his key critics, the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who was also a US citizen, was murdered. And people did think that that was a birthday gift to Putin. But October 7th was in some respects a gift for Putin, and I'm not saying this in a trite manner, because again, it opens up this other front of conflict, it puts the US in the middle of it, and it gives Putin an opportunity basically to divert attention, given all the horrors of things that are happening there, away from what he's doing in Ukraine and into the Middle East and to blame the US again for what's happening here. And Putin has really piled on there the case of the Middle East to blame America, you know, for everything that is happening, and also to rupture Russia's previously quite close relations with Israel as a consequence of October 7th. Now, I just want to say for a moment that despite everything that, you know, Putin tries to take advantage of, things are not going as well for Putin as he'd like us all to think. He is not doing as much winning as he thinks, even if, you know, he may be able to now push things in a different direction. First of all, the special military operation that Putin launched in Ukraine 2 years ago was pretty much a strategic disaster. And what he's done is actually turn, you know, that disaster around, but not yet into, you know, kind of a full position for a strategic victory. He's got himself into a full-on war, not a special military option, and he's had colossal losses of both manpower and of equipment. So, you know, he's taken 20% of Ukraine's territory, but at the cost of 500,000 deaths in total, or casualties on both the Ukrainian and the Russian side. And on the Russian side, 350,000 of those are Russian casualties, not just people who've died, but people who've been seriously injured and taken off the battlefield. You know, they've been losing, you know, about hundreds of pieces of equipment that are key equipment. And at this point, the Ukrainians have also sunk about a third of the Russian Black Sea fleet. As we fixate on the ways that Ukraine's been pushed back on land, the Ukrainians have been pushing the Russian Black Sea fleet by away. And that's actually one of the reasons that Putin wanted to take not just Crimea, but Ukraine, to basically secure the Black Sea fleet. So this has not been, let's just put it this way, an unmitigated success. We've also seen that the military's been under strain and had to rely for the first year on basically paramilitary organizations and people like the Wagner Group, run by Yevgeny Prigozhin, who mutinied in June of 2023. So not all is, you know, kind of going especially well here. Prigozhin later falls out of the sky in his airplane and he's been, you know, taken out of the picture. But Putin has had to set up a war economy now, and 40% of the Russian economy is now taken up by rearming and basically trying to reconstitute fighting power. And it's not health, innovation, education, all the things that were previously were being spent on. And I would just argue that I don't think that Russia can keep up a war economy forever without there being problems, because if we look back into Russian history, Russia was always able to wage war, but it wasn't always able to keep up with the innovation and the economy in a rapidly changing world. And the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union both fall apart because they were much more focused on winning wars or fighting wars than they were on basically building up their economies and societies. It may take a long time before we see those effects, but I would just sort of argue that it's not always going to be plain sailing, you know, for Russia out, let's say, till 2036, when Putin still hopes that he's going to be in power. Now, not everything in Ukraine or in Russia is dependent on, you know, Vladimir Putin or what's happening on the ground there, just as I said at the very beginning. We're at a pivotal moment where what we do and what we decide here in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere is going to be critical. And, you know, we're basically in the midst of wondering whether the US Congress is going to decide on whether to maintain military and political and economic support for Ukraine. This is a big debate in Europe as well, but it's resolved in already in Europe, as it should be, because of Europe's proximity to Russia and Ukraine, in favor of continuing to support Ukraine. And Ukraine is now coming back to where I started again with this reference to Pearl Harbor, just for all of us to think about, in exactly the same place as my original homeland, Britain, was from 1939 until Pearl Harbor in 1941. In that period, Britain was fighting for its independence to stop being overrun by Germany. Germany had already occupied France, not just having invaded Poland and, you know, all of the other countries in between. And 90% of Americans didn't want to support Britain. That's why Winston Churchill was spending so much time, you know, basically lobbying and, you know, trying to do what Vladimir Zelensky is doing. And, you know, I would like us to think for a moment about what it might have been like if the US had decided not to help. Now, the US was forced into the decision of helping because of Pearl Harbor. But, you know, we might have been in a very different world. I don't know. I probably wouldn't be here at Carleton College, you know, had things gone in a different direction. And that's just the kind of moment that we're in terms of a pivotal moment. The other reason, that I would say that this is pivotal for us is because of what I said earlier about the way that all of these conflicts have become intertwined, and Russia being a player not just in Europe, but in the Middle East and also in East Asia, Northeast Asia, the Asia Pacific, Indo-Pacific, because of its geographic presence there. I mean, we forget that Russia borders China, just as much as it also has a small border with North Korea. It's not just a European power. It also has the Arctic and borders with Central Asia as well. It's a big country. And I heard Tegan saying that earlier. It's when you start to say why you were studying Russian, because it's a big country, it's been there, it always will be there. it's a pretty enormous place. And as a result of the war in Ukraine over the last 2 years, Middle East and Asia have become implicated in ways we would never have thought about previously. Think back to the Olympics in Beijing in February, the Winter Olympics. Putin goes to meet with President Xi at those Olympics, and it's just a couple of weeks before the invasion of Ukraine, and he declares a limitless partnership together with President Xi, and we suspect that he said something about a special military operation and got acquiescence, at least for Xi, in that prospective invasion, although I'm not sure Xi really knew what was going to happen. But that brings China, for the very first time, into a European war. I mean, World War II, China was also a partner of the Allies, but it was really out in the Asian region. It wasn't really fighting against Germany. And now China's been providing all kinds of support to Russia. You've had lots of visits by Russian leaders to China affirming this relationship. And in addition to China, we also have North Korea that is providing assistance to Russia in the war in Ukraine. Because in that first year, Russia ran out of a lot of critical armaments, and it was kind of burning through ammunition, basically on an unparalleled scale since the major land wars of World War I and World War II. And it had to turn to North Korea for ammunition and for shells. And so North Korea has become a party to the war in support of Russia. Similarly, Iran. So here we get the Middle East connection. Iran has been providing Russia with drones because one of the reasons that Ukraine was able to beat Russia back in the early part of the war was by getting drones from Turkey and then developing its own drones. Russia is now developing its own drones, but it's been relying on Iranian drones. And of those 300 missiles and drones that were shot at Iran, by Iran against Israel, same things that Russia is using against Ukraine on a daily basis. So you see here all of the ties. Now, on that point, why are North Korea and Iran helping Russia and China, to a lesser degree, but still pretty significantly? What's their deal with Ukraine? Well, there isn't one. In fact, China was one of the largest investors in Ukraine before the war, and still continues, if you want to look on various websites, to be the largest purchaser of Ukrainian grain. China had actually leased land in Ukraine and was going to make heavy investments in Ukrainian manufacturing as well as the agribusiness sector. It's all about us, I'm afraid to say. So this is again why this is pivotal. There's a kind of axis forming with China, Iran, and North Korea and Russia, because of the way that Putin has started to talk about the war in Ukraine. He's no longer saying so much that it was about denazifying Ukraine, it was never really about that. I mean, he still talks about, obviously, NATO enlargement, all kinds of things, but he's now saying that this is an existential war, a proxy war in Ukraine against the United States and the West, because we're trying to basically push Russia out of the international arena. And that's actually, as it's become a kind of a proxy war against the United States, why China, North Korea, and Iran see this as in their interests to be supportive of Russia in the case of Ukraine. I mean, I think, it's kind of obvious why, it might be a proxy war of sorts for China. We're always talking about China all the time. We're always talking about the prospects of war between China and Taiwan and what might happen. But for China, it's also about trade and sanctions. China's watched what we've done in terms of applying sanctions against Russia. It's likely that the same thing will happen. It doesn't like, the harder trade stance that we've been taking. And all the tensions in US-China relations you know, make China think, well, why would we want there to be a win for the West or a win for the United States and Ukraine? So in many respects, we've become a kind of liability for poor Ukraine, and we were an asset. They need us to help. But it's also that lots of people are helping Russia because they want to hurt us in some way. Similarly with Iran, of course, Iran also sees Israel as a proxy for the United States, and you know, says so frequently. And obviously, since 1979, our relations with Iran have been, you know, very difficult. And you know, kind of again, they had no particular disputes with Ukraine. And then it's the same, obviously, for North Korea. I mean, we don't have to explain, you know, the difficulties in our relationship with North Korea, especially since the Korean War. And North Korea is just, you know, kind of also wanting to score points against the United States. And both Iran and North Korea are now getting more help politically, economically, and militarily from Russia than they've ever had in the past. Russia actually did not want to see North Korea and Iran destabilize their respective regions, but now does. Now, I don't think China wants to be in an axis with North Korea and Iran. China doesn't want to blow up the Middle East, but China does want to make sure that the United States doesn't necessarily prevail in a way that it could turn, and this is, again, it's thinking about the United States rather than Ukraine, turn its attention over to East Asia. So it's all thinking about how the United States can be bogged down by supporting, you know, Ukraine in the conflict. So I would say that October 7th, you know, and all these things that happened there have shifted perspectives on top of what already was happening in Ukraine. And countries are now behaving in ways that we wouldn't have expected them to. And that's why this is all so complex. And on the other side of the ledger, some of you will have been watching how the Prime Minister of Japan was recently visiting Washington, D.C., and was actually making it very clear that they were very concerned that the United States would not support Ukraine. Now, Japan actually has been quite invested in Ukraine before, so it's not just all about, you know, us in the, as in it is for others. But again, Japan's worried about the knock-on effects in all of its disputes with Russia, because Russia and Japan have a territorial dispute, also with China, and also how North Korea is going to behave. You know, Japan actually has got good relations with Iran, so that's not the issue there. But Japan is worried about knock-on effects, and so is South Korea. So South Korea and Japan are helping Ukraine. And again, this is getting more and more complex by the moment, because it shows then that lots of countries now are looking about what's happening in Ukraine and looking about what's happening in Israel, Gaza, and how that has effects on their own region. So everything has become entwined together. So again, this is a multiplicity of conflicts. And briefly, I want to talk about how, you know, there are many others that are getting affected by this as well. We've seen, for example, the Houthis in Yemen, you know, attacking shipping in the Red Sea. That's not really related to, you know, what's happening in Ukraine. But there are other regional players who worry that the Houthis will get ideas from the Ukrainians, not directly, but because the Ukrainians have been so successful in sinking Russian ships in the Black Sea with drones, that the Houthis might start doing the same thing. And then we've got ISIS, which is still alive and kicking, and recently, you know, did an attack on the Russians in Moscow. And again, you know, taking advantage of all of the conflict, my colleagues who follow ISIS said there was a lot of ISIS, you know, chatter on the internet talking about this is a great time now that all of the European, you know, Western powers at war with each other to stir things up, you know, while they're all, you know, fighting with each other. And what's the Russians done? They blame the ISIS attack on the Crocus Theater in Moscow on Ukraine and the United States when it was actually ISIS. And ISIS kept, you know, kind of waving their hands saying, no, it was us. No, it wasn't the Ukrainians, you know, kind of, and obviously kind of backfired for them a bit, but it also backfired for Russia, because Russia was so busy fighting with Ukraine and fighting with the US. We actually warned them, and so did the Iranians, that there was going to be attack on the Crocus Theater. We just got the date wrong. And they chose to, you know, basically not ignore it, but not take it very seriously. So, you know, as I was started off with these allusions to World War I and World War II and trying not to panic you and thinking we were in World War III, but we do have, you know, an analogous set of situations where both of those conflicts, World War I and World War II, had a multiplicity of different conflicts. Not everybody was fighting a war for the same reasons, but they were all kind of, you know, basically tripping over each other and ending up in the same, you know, kind of global perspective. And we run real risks of that happening again. And of course, many of the horrors of the 20th century we're seeing now, the devastation of cities, famine, you know, things that we weren't, you know, kind of, well, that's been with us for some time, but as a result of war, we're seeing massive refugee flows, horrific casualties of civilians, and trench warfare, you know, that we haven't seen since World War One, as well as all of the 21st century perspectives of drone warfare. So it seems like we just cannot get ourselves out of these horrible patterns of the past here. And in February of this year, I was at the Munich Security Conference, and the International Peace Institute, obviously peace is not really breaking out everywhere, but they're, you know, doing their best, and the Elders Group, which is a group of former top international states people, they had a session there that really, I think, you know, was quite evocative and maybe would be good for a course for here at Carleton, so I'll just make this pitch here. They convened a session tracing the 21st century line of death and destruction down one meridian. So I haven't got a globe here, but I rushed off to the globe to check this. Longitude 35, so 35 degrees, you know, going down, which extends from Ukraine through Israel and the Middle East, and then on through Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and Mozambique. All of these places having some kind of internal or, you know, external conflict, or ISIS, or, you know, some other militant group. And, you know, their gloomy prognosis was that the world order was unraveling along this line, line of longitude, meridian, you know, 35 from north to south. That would be good, you know, kind of framing for a course. But of course, the point is, we need to do something about this. You know, we obviously cannot let, you know, everything kind of fall apart like this. And the fact that they were, you know, talking about the unraveling of global order, you know, and I'm talking about the way that all these conflicts have come together, really, I think, underscores how much things have changed over, I would say, the last 20 years. In fact, you know, we thought the 21st century was going to be different, and then, of course, it begins with 9/11. And then immediately afterwards, we have the, you know, very unwise and fateful decisions of the United States to not just invade Afghanistan in response, but also Iraq. And really, everything that we're talking about now, most of these conflicts can be traced back to that sequence of events and bad choices, you know, that were made on our part and many others as well. And really, you know, what we've got here is the failure of the Western system to keep peace and to deter war. Obvious failure to integrate Russia and many other countries into, you know, kind of larger global systems, although I think, you know, we can argue that maybe not all of this was inevitable. And we also see very clearly, you know, sad to say, the loss of the United States position. You know, we are no longer the lone superpower of the 1990s, and a lot of it also has, you know, things to do with the way things have played out over the last 20 years. We still obviously get blamed for everything in the United States. Everyone still wants us to fix things or take the responsibility for everything. But the role of the United States has really changed fundamentally, and I would say has since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that actually begins in 2014 rather than in 2022 with the annexation of Crimea. And we didn't really react very strongly to that. One could also take it back to 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia. And we've been, you know, kind of in a way sleepwalking towards some of this since. So we've kind of reached the end of Pax Americana for all of our political science mergers here. And we as yet don't have anything to take the place of, you know, kind of a United States dominated international system. And that's really what we're grappling with right now. And I have a lot of faith in Carleton students, particularly those I had breakfast with this morning, to help us figure this out. But I just want to now, in the last part of my presentation here, think about some of the ways that we might need to rethink what that international system might look like. The rest of the world, the Russians like to call it the global majority. We are trying to grapple with, you know, terms for, you know, what we were calling the global south. We used to call, you know, developing world, the third world. These are all, you know, kind of descriptions from our own point of view. Let's just say everybody else that's out there in the world would really like a very different system to the one we've had since World War II and certainly since the Cold War. They don't want an international hegemon. They don't want us, they don't want China either. So, you know, just to be clear about that. They also don't want a new Cold War, and they certainly don't want a war between China and the United States because they don't want to pick sides. You know, every time that I go out and talk to, you know, people in, you know, very different places say, look, you know, we don't want to go back to that. And at Brookings, you know, where I am at the moment, we've had lots of meetings with counterparts from all the way around the world. who are just basically saying, look, enough of this. You know, we do not want to go back to Cold Wars. We don't want to be forced in every conflict to take sides, including on Ukraine or in the Middle East, because we're, you know, divided up into these two blocks. They're not interested in helping Ukraine because they say that's on you. That's a European problem. And if, you know, Ukraine loses, sorry, you know, that's kind of your problem, not ours. But, you know, I think the problem is for the rest of the world, there are going to be lots of knock-on effects if Ukraine is forced to capitulate to Russia. First of all, Russia will have proven the point that a larger power can invade another power, especially if you're a nuclear power, and get away with it. And that will have all kinds of effects elsewhere in the world where there are lots of territorial disputes or lots of claims made by one country, you know, against the other. So you'll have, you know, a lot of questions about whether war works and whether the use of force works. And again, there'll be nuclear proliferation issues too, because, you know, we remember that Ukraine had to give up its nuclear weapons that it inherited from the Soviet Union, as did Belarus and Kazakhstan, in the 1990s. And we said that we would help protect them against just what's happening now. And obviously we haven't done a very good job of that. So lots of countries are wondering now whether they should get nuclear weapons, you know, for example. So that's a knock-on effect that we'll have. Also, a capitulation of Ukraine to Russia would not bring lasting peace to Europe. A failed state in Ukraine would mean even more refugees and instability. Russia's already turning kind of coercive attention towards its other neighbors. As I said before, Belarus has kind of disappeared. The Moldovans know they're in trouble, the Kazakhs and Kazakhstan. The Finns and, you know, Swedes have joined NATO because they're worried about, you know, broader European security implications. And, you know, Europe's got bogged down in thinking about what's happening in Ukraine. We're not out there being helpful anywhere else, really. You know, this is going to be bandwidth taken up, and more money will be spent on rearming because of worries about Russia over the longer term and not being spent on foreign aid or, you know, in other places. Ukraine's defeat will also highlight, thanks to the way that Putin has talked about it, the weakness of the West, not just the United States, but also Europe. The failure of, you know, European security institutions and the failure of deterrence, because Putin was not deterred by the idea that Europe would do anything. He's deterred by the United States and the idea of NATO, but not by European countries individually or even collectively. And Taiwan's premier recently warned, look, you know, kind of if deterrence fails in Europe, where you're all in NATO, is it really going to work in the Asia-Pacific region? And that's what Japan and South Korea are wondering too. So, you know, there's an issue as well. Now, not all of those points are getting much traction outside, but they still have to be talked about. They're not getting much traction here in the United States if, you know, again, you know, we read J.D. Vance and others' op-eds. And outside of the Transatlantic Alliance, and actually often when I'm reading newspaper commentary at the moment, most people seem to think Russia's already won. I was in Chicago a week ago, and there was a Brazilian diplomat who was visiting at the Harris School, and he said, well, Russia's won. I said, well, actually, no, they haven't yet. You know, I got a bit irritated. And he said, well, yes, they have. I mean, they dominate Eastern Europe. We'll tell that to the Poles, you know, and the Balts, you know, because he was citing Hungary and Slovakia and comments that they've made. And he said, there's no turning back. And I was like, there is. They haven't won. You know, they've got 20% of Ukraine's territory. They haven't got all of it. And he said, yes, but they will have, because you're not going to do anything. You know, so this is kind of part of the issue. And our pessimism is feeding into this as well. Because he said, you know, you're already talking about them, you know, losing. So that's it, you know, it's over. Well, it's not over. You know, so this is, unfortunately, though, a view that's consolidating. And that view is making, you know, diplomats from other countries think accordingly. So the Brazilians, you know, are courting the Chinese. They're not as interested in looking to the United States or Europe, you know, for example. And we could go on about this, South Africans and many others. You know, countries joining the BRICS, you know, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, that's extending out to 19 countries. They're all looking for different options because they think we're finished. And that, you know, kind of Europe and the United States are, you know, going off somewhere. And anyway, they want less attention, you know, to the US and Europe in world affairs too. So a number of my counterparts at other think tanks have been thinking all this through and thinking, what does this world order look like? And they say, it looks like a la carte internationalism. You know, where you just kind of pick and choose what you want to do. But all of the world actually thinks that's what we've been doing, the United States, since we invaded Iraq. They kind of understood Afghanistan after 9/11, but not Iraq. And they think, well, the United States has been doing a la carte internationalism, So why are we doing anything different? In other words, picking and choosing, you know, our adherence to international law or, you know, kind of what countries we're going to invade or not invade. And Putin's saying, I just want to do the same thing. I want to do the same thing as the United States. So the onus is on us now to kind of figure out how we do things differently and with other players. So just now wrapping up, because I know that Noel will want to get onto the questions and answers, there's a lot of things that we have to think about how we're going to do things differently. First of all, the world is changing dramatically, not just geopolitically. We have got rapid economic change, technological change, demographic change. We've got 8 billion people, you know, here. We've just come through COVID, which has ruptured, you know, many of our supply routes and all the ways of doing business. We all seem to have forgotten that. Although not everyone has, I still see people masked here because we are still living in a world of pandemics. There's avian flu and all kinds of things that we need to be thinking about. And it's changing so rapidly that many of us can't keep up. And we have within our own societies many people who have not just not kept up with geopolitical changes and all these changes, but have fallen behind, not just economically, but in educational terms, in terms of their life outcomes. And, you know, people vote. This is a really critical year in 2024. And it's not just a critical year for us in our elections. 4 billion people in 64 countries are going to the ballot box. You know, let's forget Russia's election. But, you know, the other elections, you know, are really meaningful. People have choices, and they want to see a different world. The people who feel, you know, left behind in terms of economics also feel left behind in terms of our politics. And they certainly don't feel like they've got part in all of these, you know, global issues. And that's at home and also abroad. I know the kind of the attitudes of the rest of the world feeling like they're not left, they're not part of the international system is the same at home where people feel that they're not part of our domestic system either. So we're kind of mirroring inside our own societies the international dilemma. We've got north-south risks, east-west, center-periphery, coast-interior. You know, these are all the kinds of things that we're talking about. So inside of the domestic and international system at the moment, everybody's asking, well, who gets to have a say? You know, who decides what changes? Who pays for change? Who benefits? Who doesn't? Who's to blame? That's always a question. The Russians are always asking that. It usually is. And, you know, can someone fix everything? Well, there is no one solution. An election won't fix everything. Choosing one person won't fix everything. It's really about how we all pull together. So I think, you know, the key issue at the root of every question that we have right now, and we have that obviously in the 2024 elections, is not just going back to the past and relitigating the past. I mean, all the questions are always about, you know, how were things 4 years ago, or make America great again, or make Russia great again. That's what Putin's, you know, thinking about. And Putin wants to make Russia great again based on his interpretations of the 9th century, or sometimes the 18th century, depending if he's in his Catherine the Great mode, or he's Yaroslav the Wise, or all these kind of characters from Russia's past that he likes to think about. But it's really how we're going to build the future based on where we are from the present. And as we have, you know, a young audience with us here at Carleton College, and everybody's, you know, trying to think about the future, that's kind of where we are right now. And so our big challenge as we, you know, kind of think about where we're going to go out from here is how do we reinvigorate and reshape the international system so we can grasp the future, even if it's complex. We need a 360-degree view of everything, because all these things are interconnected. But we also need humility and flexibility and creativity to find solutions. So can we find some kind of international order that isn't just rooted in, you know, European security or the transatlantic partnership? I mean, that's kind of a question. I mean, we're grappling right now with it. Even the United States and Europe are on the same page anymore. And that's kind of a question, you know, all the time. What's the purpose of NATO? What's the purpose of European security? Is there a new world order if Europe and, you know, the United States are not part of it, for example? And Europe and the United States have got differences on economic issues, on climate change, also on military security issues. There's a big question now, can Europe step up to help Ukraine by building up its defense production? How do we show, you know, resolve? You know, how do we, you know, become better security players? How do we think about all the different forms of security, human security, food security? I mentioned that, you know, kind of before. And beyond all of that, how can we, the United States and our European other allies, think about a new international system that brings in all these different perspectives and voices that are out there, the Brazilians, the South Africans, the people from Mozambique, Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, not just India and China and all of the other big players. And how do they have a say in creating a new international order? They actually did after World War II, and we had the UN General Assembly, but we've kind of lost the perspective there. The UN right now is grappling with sustainable development goals and the Summit for the Future. But countries are not themselves digging deep and asking the same questions about our institutions really fit for purpose now for addressing all these rapid changes and for finding a voice for all of us there. We're very diverse. The United States is unbelievably diverse. How do we get a voice for everybody in creating a new system, not just the tyranny of one group over another all the time? And that's what the international system is about as well. They don't want to be forced into these situations where somebody else is addressing all of the domestic challenges for them. We're already seeing, just to wrap up here, middle powers and smaller countries playing a role in trying to address the conflicts in Ukraine. There's all kinds of countries out there with their own peace plans. The Ukrainians are trying to bring everyone together in Switzerland in June, to kind of talk about all this and see how, they can move forward. We see Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates all trying to think about what to do in the Middle East. It's not just us and Turkey and other countries, for example. And I mentioned India before, and the Indian Foreign Minister, Jai Shankar, is writing all the time about a new global order and the role that India and other, huge countries might play in all of this. So I think the challenge for us right now and for all the students who are taking classes is try to think about how we engage in the future with new sets of actors, not just ignore them. And just because we're not in the same position as we were doesn't mean that we can't kind of work with others to think about a new approach to international affairs. Because whether we like it or not, other countries are shaping things. And if we're not part of that, they'll just move on, without us, especially as we start, fighting with ourselves all the time in and around elections. So basically, this year, 2024, is a pretty pivotal year of choices. I'm glad that many people who are here today have chosen to come to Carleton, but those are not the only choices that we have to make. But this is a year for making choices about the future at the ballot box in terms of coming to college and also in the global arena. And I'd love to, if we've got a bit of time, to do some questions as well. So thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Fiona, too. We appreciate your talk. As you mentioned, we're going to have Q&A for those of you who are able to stick around. Just a few words. Because we have so many people, I was going to say a word about Convo. You already did a great plug for Convo in your introduction. Thank you very much for that. But just to mention, next week we will have, on April 26th, Brian Sostick, class of 1990, a writer, choreographer, director, performer, and teaching specialist at the U of M. His talk will be entitled Fear, Failure, and Catastrophe, How to Talk to Strangers and People You Think You Know. On May 3rd, we'll have Pipo Nguyen Nui, class of 83, a fine art photographer. And then May 10th, that is the food insecurity one we were talking about. That's going to be Jill Conklin, director and strategic officer of Food for Soul. That is also the date of Carleton's Empty Bowls program. There will not be a Convo lunch because Convo lunch will be on the bald spot. Everyone will be invited to buy a bowl that's hand in hand with our ceramics department, and you buy some soup. Or you buy the bowl and then you get the soup, I forget exactly. But this all goes to help fund the local food shelf. It's a wonderful program, and this is the 20th year, 20th anniversary as well. So speaking of lunch, those of you who have RSVP'd for lunch afterwards with Fiona, excellent, because we are full. If you haven't RSVP'd, I'm afraid we are full today. Now, that's enough of me. Let's move to the Q&A. Who would like to start us off?
If I may, I have two related questions.
Great.
One is, Trump has threatened to extricate the United States from NATO. Can he? Will he? And if so, what happens?
Okay.
And tomorrow, the House is debating on an aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Are we headed to an isolationist category as we were before World War I and World War II?
Yeah, and those two questions are, obviously interrelated as well. On the NATO question, actually, this was even a bipartisan effort, which is kind of rare at present, to actually make sure that actually Trump and any other president couldn't actually pull the United States out of NATO without any kind of congressional or Senate role. So technically, right now he can't. But he can talk it down. And, you know, obviously the root of Article 5 is not just the the mutual defense, but it's also that idea of Article 5 that people will come to your defense and help you out in a time of trouble. And the only time that Article 5 has been invoked, by the way, was after 9/11. I'm sure many of you are aware of that, when NATO did come to the United States assistance and, you know, was protecting the skies and all kinds of, you know, things just in case there were more terrorist attacks. And of course, then NATO came along with us on, you know, many of our misadventures in Afghanistan and Iraq as well. So if, Trump is eroding the idea of Article 5, I mean, it just makes NATO fairly meaningless. And, you know, as I alluded to in my presentation, Europeans are already thinking about that. Now, you'd think, well, why have the Finns and the Swedes joined NATO then? If, you know, that's kind of might be less, it's because they're seeing it as the only mechanism for working together to rethink European security. And even without the United States, they'd be trying to do something. And NATO is a very convenient convening mechanism for this, because people have got all these experiences of working together, you know, interoperability, shared command, et cetera, et cetera. And everyone is worried about that isolationist moment. It was all of the talk at the Munich Security Conference. I spent 6 months last year in Germany. Germans are really worried, you know, kind of they've made a lot of mistakes over the last several years. They kind of outsourced their security to us. I mean, I think none of us would have advised them to do that. I mean, for decades, we've been telling Europeans, you need to do more. Well, now they've actually realized, yep, we do. And, you know, irrespective of what choices, you know, are kind of made over the weekend on Iran and Ukraine and also Taiwan, the rest of the world's got the message that they can't really rely on us. And we flip a switch every 4 years or every 8 years if, you know, somebody gets two terms and, you know, the next person who comes in, if they're not from the same party, tries to undo everything that the person did before. I mean, what kind of, you know, reliable partner is that? You know, they're just like this all the time, you know, wondering where's the United States going. And right now, all of the things that have been happening here have had the effect of getting the rest of the world to just kind of want on to move on without us, even, you know, our own allies. So that's going to have all these knock-on effects. And even if we decide that we're not going down that trend, that path of isolation, and we want to reinvigorate ourselves, it doesn't have to be military, it has to be diplomatic and everything else and just engaging. As I've already mentioned, the world's going to be a different place, because everyone's making plans without us. You know, we've become the loony, you know, kind of relative over in the corner. And, you know, while we're doing whatever it is we're doing over there, everyone else getting on with, you know, whatever else they have to do. And I'm sorry, that's really the kind of, you know, what I hear all the time. Yeah.
I have a question about violence and force and the accumulation of power and advantage. Ooh, yep. And it seems like that's at the core of how systems get created. And once they're created, those who are at the top of that system want to talk about, let's keep the peace. Is there any way to untie that knot, or is there any thinking about that kind of idea in your group?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that's really kind of where the Europeans had gone. You know, they were kind of living in what they thought was an era now of perpetual peace and prosperity, you know, and built up from the ruins of World War II and deciding they were never going to, you know, go back to this again. Now, of course, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we've had a lot of, you know, turmoil. And look, I would say that this is still the collapse of the Soviet Union wars being fought out. And the same in the Balkans after the collapse of Yugoslavia. So it's not like Europe has been untouched by war in all of this period. But the Europeans were definitely trying to kind of start to think about a whole new system that would be more focused on peace rather than the results of war. Now, the Russians are still, you know, kind of around Putin, not writ large, but certainly around Putin, still of the mind that, exactly as you're saying, you know, the victors get to say what the peace is. And if we were living in a Pax Americana, well, then we can live in a different Pax, you know, name, you know, somebody else out there. And all it takes is an act of war to change the system. And usually, in fact, if we look at World War I, World War II, or maybe we call them world wars, even though a lot of them, you know, started off really in Europe, it was that global system-changing effect that made them world wars, because they changed the system, and it was the victors of the war that, you know, kind of shaped the system afterwards. And, you know, that's still, you know, viewed in the rest of the world. But there's that demand now, as I've mentioned, from other countries to do something different. And although we may think that the UN isn't really, you know, doing much, and at times it seems very ineffective, there's still a great desire, you know, outside of the United States and elsewhere, to put more emphasis on the UN General Assembly and on these ideas of sustainable development goals, Summit for the Future, climate change, poverty eradication, you know, trying to make the world, you know, the better place kind of idea. A lot of countries would still like to use that mechanism. And also to establish an international law that everyone can agree with, not just cherry pick from. So most countries don't want to be invaded by their neighbors. And, you know, we didn't do a great service to that principle when we invaded Iraq and, you know, previously Afghanistan. And so there's a lot more demand for other countries to really basically now cement that idea of the international law that we agreed on after World War II. And that's also something that's going to get to be pushed, which is kind of more adherence to the international law that we've all agreed on, especially when it comes to issues of war and peace. And that's, again, what Ukraine is trying to do with this conference in Switzerland, is trying to get a kind of a reaffirmation that war is not the basically solution to not just your beefs with your neighbors, but to, you know, kind of creating new systems. So, I mean, it's exactly the right question to ask. We're just not there yet and be able to answer it in a way that I think that you were, you know, pushing us towards. But we have to show, in the case of Ukraine and elsewhere, that war does not work, you know, in terms of system change. And we have to, you know, live up to that as well. That's the challenge, you know, really that we're in at the moment.
It seems clear to me that the last three incarnations of Russia, from the Tsar Empire to the Soviet Union to the modern Russian Federation, have retained the core of being a city around, an imperial center around Moscow and St. Petersburg, and then colonial periphery in the rest of the country. And it seems like this has produced similar effects every time, like Russia seems chronically incapable of not invading its neighbors. Should we not be pursuing a more proactive policy to decolonize and dismantle the Russian imperial structure as a NATO and Western strategy to stop this sort of thing from occurring? Because it's clear if they win in Ukraine, they're going to try and invade the Baltics next.
Well, I think we have to be, you know, somewhat careful about that. I think, you know, the main thing is to actually show that we would not just let the Ukrainians put up a fight, but we would put up a fight as well if the, you know, the next, you know, kind of dominoes fall. And that gets back to the question about NATO. If you're basically saying, you know, as Trump did, I don't care if anybody, you know, if Russia invades, come on, invade. If people are not defending themselves, you've got a problem. And that would put the Baltic states or, you know, anyone else in peril. So, you know, first of all, we've got to show that we have resilience, we've got a robust defense, and we mean business. In other words, that we do not want, you know, war to work. And I think that would then be changing the calculations. So one of the reasons that Putin invaded Ukraine was because he thought he could. Because we didn't do very much, you know, after Georgia in 2008. We didn't do much at all after 2014 when he annexed Crimea. I mean, it's not Russian territory. Catherine the Great annexed Crimea. Again, Catherine the Great, you know, back in the 1780s. He did not belong to Russia before. If you look at maps, Putin always says, well, Ukraine's not on the map. And, you know, Crimea's not on the map, you know, as if it didn't exist before. Well, it was actually. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. The Swedes were there. You know, there was all kinds of things on the map. It doesn't, you know, kind of, it didn't just appear in, you know, the 1700s, you know, for example. And what we have to basically be making it clear is that imperial mindset doesn't work. And, you know, we haven't been very good at that ourselves. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, I think, you know, I'm British to start with, but I've lived in, you know, America much longer than I did in Britain. It's always easy to think of Britain as an empire. And empires started at home with the Welsh and the Irish and, you know, kind of went on from there. But it's often difficult for us to think that America's an empire as well. You know, we bought a lot of territory. There was Louisiana Purchase. There was, you know, the Alaska. You know, the Russians were in California as well. But, you know, Hawaii wasn't part of the ancient, you know, kind of American, you know, core countries. The Brits had been there. It used to be called the Sandwich Islands. You know, it's kind of the Earl of Sandwich who gave us the sandwich. Also took, you know, Hawaii paid for, you know, the kind of conquest of, you know, weird British people out there. You know, so there's all these kinds of ways in which we've expanded out the Philippines, you know, different points, Puerto Rico, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have to also think ourselves about our own conduct and, you know, moving forward. You know, we've not always been great in the past, but we've got every day is a new day. You know, we can, you know, shape things in a different way. And that would also be a message. to Putin, because he's always trying to say, what about the United States, or what about this country, and what about what everybody else is doing? And the more permissive an environment you have, the more likely, you know, somebody like Putin, who has that kind of imperial worldview, is going to act. But I want to say that we can't always think that every Russian will behave the same. Mikhail Gorbachev did not, neither did Boris Yeltsin. And partly, it wasn't just because Russia didn't have the capability, it's they had a different mindset. Gorbachev wanted to end the Cold War because he had, you know, realized it was going to end up in a ruinous clash, and he wanted to, you know, he was actually a committed communist and wanted to keep the Communist Party, but he also wanted to, you know, rethink things at home. Boris Yeltsin, you know, was trying to build up a new post-Soviet Russia. Not every Russian leader, you know, has necessarily thought in the same way. And Putin, I think, you know, starts to think more aggressively because the environment becomes more permissive. And so we have to make a less permissive environment.
We're at time, but we're going to sneak one more question in, so you get it.
How do you view the increasing use of propaganda in conflicts? We have companies and governments who, through the technology of recent years, have had much more knowledge and information on how human beings tick, how they make decisions and adhere to certain parties. What is this role in how this conflict unfolds?
Yeah, it's unfortunately playing quite a big role. And it's actually one of the reasons why I'm not really on social media. You'll find me on LinkedIn, but that's just mostly so I can say hi to you and, you know, help you maybe find a job. But I'm not posting anything on there, nor am I really reading anything that anybody else posts for precisely this problem. We are awash at all times in a sea of propaganda, you know, from domestic sources as well as foreign sources. X has become just exactly that, a big horrible X, you know, on the blot on the map, with just anything X-rated and, you know, you name it, basically being perpetrated, you know, with no real, you know, kind of sense of purpose, but giving even more, you know, kind of fuel to the kind of propaganda that you're talking about. So, you know, one of the ways in which we have to be able to push back about that is getting ourselves better informed. You know, basically be more critical about, you know, what you, I'm not saying you particularly, I'm thinking my daughter actually, the mum's always on bloody TikTok. You know, what is it that you're looking at? You know, beyond, you know, dancing in the mirror and doing little dances. What information are you getting there? Where is it coming from? You know, that's what we learn at universities, to be more critical, you know, about the kinds of information, you know, that we're getting, and to, you know, start to challenge assumptions and, you know, challenge our own. And you're absolutely right that we're in a world now where some of the most critical players are people like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, and all of them are the eight guys from Silicon Valley who have created, you know, many of these mechanisms. There's no accountability for them whatsoever. I mean, occasionally they get called up in front of Congress, but they can be much more powerful than any other international leader, which is exactly why Elon Musk, who I think is one of the world's most dangerous people, just to be very clear, wanted to buy X, precisely so he could manipulate the information space. Is he elected? No, he's not. Are we able to rein him in? No, we're not, because he's the world's richest man. I mean, we're back here at the Gilded Age, you know, the kind of time when this university was founded, and one in which extraordinarily rich people can become demagogues, you know, basically in their own right. And it takes all of us, you know, to basically push back. Don't sign up, you know. I mean, I know it's very difficult to, you know, then keep track of things. Don't use these tools. Start thinking of others that could be more responsive. I mean, the internet can be extraordinarily useful. I mean, all of us, you know, use it in different ways. But many of these tools are bringing great harm and are being used for harmful purposes. So it's incumbent on all of us to start to think about how we tackle this. When I was at the Bosch Academy last year, I was working with a host of really quite amazing people who were, you know, tech people themselves, including the person who's the president of Signal, you know, and others, who were all thinking about how to make these tools more responsive to people, you know, to be used for things that we actually would like to have them used for, rather than being used for, you know, social manipulation and political manipulation and by adversaries who are, you know, trying to push us in different ways. There's no easy answer to this, but I think the very fact that you laid it out like that also shows that most of us are now cottoning on, you know, to the fact that we've become in a dangerous place and become very vulnerable because of a reliance on tools that can be used, you know, to feed information. And frankly, it's hard to decide what's domestic propaganda and what's international foreign propaganda. Putin operates like a super PAC, a political action committee. That's another thing. I mean, we can do something about that. We can lobby Congress and, you know, lobby, you know, the Supreme Court to overturn the citizens, you know, US legislation, for example, that meant that the more money you have, the more voice you have in society. That's not, you know, kind of a fair situation. You know, all of us are supposed to go out to become billionaires so that we can buy our own, you know, basically outlets so we can have a say. I mean, that's, again, what's at stake in the 2024 elections. One person, you know, one vote, a voice, no matter how you decide. And that's what I'm basically saying about trying to figure out how we can have more responsive systems. I'm saying this from a non-ideological perspective, just to be very clear. But I've, you know, spent my whole life, you know, as a kid who came from nowhere, you know, my father going down a coal mine at age 14, trying to think, how do people like, you know, me in the middle of nowhere where nobody knows who we are, have a voice? And, you know, we get a voice, you know, education offers us a doorway, a portal, coming to, you know, places like this and engaging with people. So then how do we have a say in the information space and in making it more responsive for us? And I think there are ways, and, you know, I hope you're studying, you know, computer science and other kind of things and, you know, thinking yourself about how to make things more responsive, because a lot of other people are as well. And again, I just want to say, as this is the end of the questions, I just loved coming to places like Carlton, because there were just so many incredibly smart people with the whole future, you know, ahead of you. And I just really hope that you will help us, all of us, you know, particularly those of us who've been making a mess for the last God knows how many decades, you know, find a way out of this. And, you know, we're relying on you as well to help us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Fiona.